Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody and happy Tuesday night. Chris Jordan here, coming at you live from Austin. Hope everybody is doing well amidst the madness in the world right now as riots are happening all over the country. Never forget, there's a difference between voices being heard and instigators, folks. There are two separate things going on simultaneously. And even the fact that just the other night, I posted it on the Curious Realm group, a picture from a friend of mine's cousin who was literally like out attending a show at the Hollywood Bowl. Like, not all of LA is like that. It's just a slice, just a little segment. So remember what the media is always pushing at you. You know, remember that doctrine of didactic that has to exist for control. Those things are out there, and that's a lot of what some of our coming guests will be. Speaking of coming guests, in our second part tonight, we have Nikki Folsom as our pre-record guest. We will be talking about people of the Fae, mythology, fact, warnings, things like that. Next week, we are glad to welcome back our good friend Chester Moore. His new documentary, Gulf Coast Great Whites, is coming out and premiering at the Museum of the Gulf Coast in Port Aransas, Texas. So that is coming up June 21st. So if you are available, folks, hop on down, support Chester. We will be having Chester on next week to discuss that. And in addition, next week, we will be having our good friend King Gerhard on to talk about his new book, The Essential Mothman, or The Essential Guide to Mothman and Other Winged Cryptids. So we'll be talking about Mothman and Winged Cryptids next week, as well as Great Whites in the Gulf Coast. If you're like me and grew up swimming in what we call the Bay of Yoo-Hoo out in Houston, that nice murky water known as Galveston, dude, there are great white sharks out there. So it's wild. It's interesting. We'll be talking about that next week. Our guest in this segment tonight, folks, our live guest, is Richard Smith. He is a prominent figure in the arts community for the city of Rio Rancho. He also owns his own business and runs 1122 Creative. He's an accomplished author of thought-provoking books and delves into the impact of ancient historical and extraterrestrial narratives on our society and culture. And that is one of the reasons I wanted to have him on, in addition to the fact that he's an experiencer, and one of the things that we have had on regularly on this show, Joshua Shapiro, is somebody who receives packets of downloads of information from spirit, as he has called it numerous times on the show. And it's fascinating to me, Richard, the experiencers that I know out there that do receive downloads of data in this kind of way. We'll be talking tonight about some of the downloads that you've received regarding Solomon's Temple, things like that. Welcome to the show tonight to begin with.
Thank you.
If you don't mind sharing, I know it can be very hard for some experiencers despite time, even despite speaking about it. But if you don't mind, would you mind sharing your first memory of experience? Because you've had experiences throughout your entire life. So when was the first time that it really keyed into you that something different was happening to you, Richard?
Sure. That's always a good place to start. And for me, it was at the age of 21. I had my first awakening at that point. And in that experience, this extraterrestrial entity, who I referred to in the books as the Crone, made herself known to me. She just appeared there. And I describe her in detail in the books as a female praying mantis. In fact, book one in the trilogy, I actually get into giving a descriptive detail about how she looks. And when she appeared to me, my first reaction was, I was shocked. But at the same time, there was a calming effect because I looked at her and said, I know you. How do I know you? It didn't jog. And then all of a sudden, because of her presence, all these memories came flooding back to me that I thought were dreams or nightmares, you know, and then there was this familiarity with her that she had been there in the backdrop of my life since I was 4 years old.
Interesting.
So it's that there was always in what was what I finally realized wasn't a dream. What, all those memories that came back were in dreams. I realized there was, yeah, there was always that feeling as a child or a teenager in having those quote unquote experiences that there was some obscure figure in the backdrop that I could never put my finger on. And then it turned out it was her.
Okay.
And then we had that was the beginning of what I call the conversation, which has now spanned all these years. In that initial conversation, she said, you know, would you take the information that's downloaded to you and use it to turn it into your artwork to basically teach people what's going on their planet or with the phenomena? And I said, sure. And she knew that I had just decided to go back to college and focus on visual arts at the State University of New York, Old Westbury. So the two things just dovetailed together right at that moment. My professors there, they were a little iffy when I sat there and had to explain it to them what I was going to devote my art tutorials to in my final exhibition. Mm. My main mentor, he saw the side of it that made sense. He said, okay, you can, let's do this, but keep it grounded, keep it serious. Okay. Because he saw the way I was talking about it was not so much the same way as other people were bringing it up. Cause I was making connections to, things like equal rights, civil rights, women's rights, everyday social current affairs, basically showing people how the mundane and the profane exist on the same level with each other.
Okay.
Using it. And what was interesting was in that initial conversation that started off with the crone, she said, you know, I'll guide you to the mentors and teachers you need to fill in the gaps. Well, that started off in college with those professors. Because my one mentor, he said, all that I ask is that you do not make it illustrative, make it something that grabs the viewer and pulls them in, make it interact with the viewer so that when they walk away from it, they feel like they've walked away with the experience too. And ultimately that's what I tried to do in that whole series.
and now, when was it just the one teacher that you had, or have you had, and like you said, you tied this manted being to experiences that you'd had your entire life? Was it the fact that the being was just there observing, or was the being a part of things and moving things along in these experiences?
I think both of those are the answer, and here's the reason why. She's been very interactive with both my wife and I ever since we were very young. In fact, it turned out when I met Linda and we started comparing notes, we realized we were having crossover experiences. And of course, the synchronicity being we met each other at the opening reception of that art exhibition I put on with the whole series of artwork. So that all was a powerful synchronicity at the time. Other people I've crossed paths with that have seen what I talk about, where I'm going, they have helped fill in the gaps on the way. And I actually name them in the books, who they are. But for the most part, it's been the crone who is both observer and interactive. She is part of, and in some cases perceived as the leader of, the sisterhood, this group of multi-genotype beings. Humans are in there too. I described them in the book as, you could see them as the midwives between Earth and the galactic community.
Okay.
They basically are on the lookout for any gifted children who might be at risk for other bad actors coming after them. So they stand in as the vanguard and stop that. That's been going on since the beginning of time. I mean, you know, nowadays we call them super psychic kids or indigos or starborn hybrids. But back in the day, they used the term Christ child. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Back and forth. Or avatar, or, you know, terms like that. So this is I would say the reincarnation of Buddha is an example of that too. So this has been going on right into today. We just use different terms today. And they make sure that these children aren't used and abused by the other side of the equation. They have been, especially the crone, who is this primordial being. She's basically, her race is so old, you know, the human mind couldn't even relate to it. And they are a race of healers. There may not be too many of them left out there, but there's enough, you know, they get around. But she is part of the sisterhood there, and they are on the lookout. They work with the Star Nations and the benevolent factions of the galactic community. You could see the sisterhood in a lot of ways in the way the warrior class of women are depicted in Black Panther.
Okay.
That's one aspect of it. The other side of it is the Bene Gesserit women in Dune. So you take those two and put them together, you have the sisterhood.
Fascinating. And do they, is it like a collective mind amongst them, or is it more a council of individual beings?
I think from what we've seen, it's more so a council, but a lot of discussion between them does seem to take place telepathically, especially with the crone. I mean, you know, I can hear her talk to me in my head. I'll talk to her like normal. You know, she jokes about it. She says, you know, one of these days you'll get the hang of the way I talk to you. So
I was going to ask, is it the fact that the telepathic communication runs both ways, or do you physically have to speak?
It does. And I think I've gotten better at it over the years. So, but when I was younger, it was more about expedience. But then as you get older, you start being more introspective about the whole thing.
No.
And I think it gives you some time to go that way.
Well, and with that in mind, especially with the fact that this has happened over the course of your life, was there any point that because of course, like you said, originally you thought that they were dreams.
Yeah.
Things like that. Were you ever afraid? Was it ever the fact that like these were, was it always a benevolent experience, these dreams, or what, did it start off in a different way and you came to understand it in a different way?
My experiences had always been very educational. The crone is very much like the way certain Native American folklore would describe the crone. Very, can be a harsh taskmaster at times, but also your greatest defender. She's the eyes in the back of your head, no matter what. She always has your back, but, and if she, sees you as someone that, she needs to take under her wing for a little bit longer into adulthood, you know, That's an interesting relationship that develops there over time. But I asked her at one point, what about those other experiences that I'm remembering when I was a kid that were far and above, you know, anything nice and educational or otherwise? They were very threatening. And so she brought one to mind. She says, you remember that? And she called it the kitchen episode. You remember the kitchen episode? I said, yes. She says, now, do you remember why you were in the kitchen? And I had to think about it. And then it came back to me. When I was in my bedroom as a kid, you're probably thinking about, what, 6 years old, seven, you know, something like that, five, six. I had my my stuffed animals, okay? And a couple of them were very big at you know, at 5 or 6 years old. Big could be anything, you know. But I had, there was a large, very large lion, a very large rabbit that was quite tall and towered over me when you stood it upright. Then there was the Raggedy Ann doll. Then there was the teddy bear and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Well, one day I'm in the bedroom, or I thought I was. Obviously, this was the experience. They all decided to get up and start talking in a very threatening manner towards me. And it was almost like they were conspiring with each other, saying things like, oh, we got him alone. We can get him now. Nobody's looking. And I could feel the vibes coming off. I was like, these are not my stuffed animals. There's something wrong with you. And before they could do anything about it, I booked out of the room across the hallway into the kitchen. Now, I'm not sure why. But for some reason, in the back of my mind, I knew the kitchen was the safe spot they couldn't cross over into. It was like a barrier there. And they came to, it was almost like the threshold of the bedroom was their barrier. They couldn't cross that threshold into the hallway. And so they're all now lined up at the doorway looking at me in a very menacing manner across the hallway. And I'm in the kitchen like, you can't get me here. And there's a symbolism there to the kitchen I'll explain too. But what happened at that point is that I remembered that I started seeing what they really looked like. So it wasn't my stuffed animals, definitely not. That was just being put into my head as a trick. But I started looking at them and I started realizing, oh, that's who you are. And it was these others that I've described in the books as, in a very specific way, what I refer to in the books as the Grays. And they realized that I saw that, and that I saw them. And they, one whispered to the other, he can see who we are. He's not supposed to be able to do that. And I said, you can't cross over here. And you have to leave now. And something happened at that point that did make them go away. And then the crone came back into the conversation and said, now, do you remember? I said, yeah. So she says, I had you in the kitchen there. That was my barrier. Now, symbolism of the kitchen has, throughout what I call the Invisible College, which I read about in part three, the kitchen has always been the symbolism of the heart of the house, the safe zone. You see this in like the Matrix. Where does Neo go to meet the Oracle? In the kitchen. That's the safe area. Okay. Some psychics might refer to the kitchen as the heart of the house where everything crosses. Okay. It's that, it traditionally, and I don't say this in any kind of jaded manner, but that's where your mom or your grandma cooks. Okay. So there's that female principle, that old wives' knowledge and wisdom. Kitchen. Okay. There have been other references to that in many movies. Okay. about the kitchen being, that safe spot there. In the movie Poltergeist with Jo Beth Williams, where does she discover all this taking place with her daughter? In the kitchen.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
It's a repeating theme throughout. So it didn't surprise me that that barrier in the kitchen was where the chrome put me to be safe.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because you bring up an interesting part that we talk about and experience all the time, Richard. And I've got a very rote phrase that I use on the show, and that is the fact that I believe that there is a large hominid being roaming the woods of North America and beyond.
Yeah.
But I think that there is also something else that will gladly take the form of whatever trope we have in our mind that we would be comfortable with.
Oh yeah.
As a form of consent to access to us. And that's literally exactly what you're talking about. When these occupying things that came and tried to do something bad to you appeared, they appeared and took the form of your stuffed animals. The things that you were familiar with and okay with, that, you know, hey, maybe you wouldn't question if you had an experience with Raggedy Ann that night, you know. But fortunately, in that state, you were called to the kitchen, to the safety, you know. And that's fascinating to see that even in your dream state, which of course you come to realize later is not actually a dream state, but the fact that these beings were willing to use even your childlike love against you.
Oh yeah.
You know,
it took a little while for me to, trust those things in my bedroom again.
Yeah.
Cause at that point I'm looking at them like the way the brother in Poltergeist is looking at that wicked clown on the chair. Okay.
Yeah. You think? And you know, that brings up a big point. I mean, of course, at that point, you trust the being that you have regular experience with and that you've realized has been there the whole time. How does a download begin for you, Richard? Does it necessarily have to have experience tied to it for you? How does that communication work now that the two of you are in simpatico connection in that kind of way?
It doesn't have to be a physical experience.
Okay.
It could happen in your sleeping hours where your alpha waves are a little higher at that point and more receptive.
Sure.
I think a lot of that more so applies to children, though. They're more adept at that. And they're at an age where, you know, I was at an age where you can see right through the veil. You can see what's trying to camouflage itself. Not that it's necessarily a bad thing. But as you get older, you know, you take it as a conversation going on back and forth telepathically. Other times, she'll come to me in my sleeping hours. And the so-called quote-unquote dreams, which weren't really dreams, that's how I got going with all three books. And the three books, it took 10 years to get that trilogy done. But when I get rocking and rolling on writing, it's all flooding through me. She's basically standing right behind me, you know.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, basically going at it until it's finished. I'm mentally exhausted every time I finish a book.
Oh, yeah. And
because of all that. And usually I have to take a break between books before I go back at it again. So, but each one gets a little thicker than the last. And because there's more going into it, by the time I finished part three last year, I was like, okay, I got to take a mental break. I know what we need to do next, but I'm not getting to it this year. I'm going to maybe go back to it next year in 2025. So,
yeah. take a little break. Now with that being said, let's get into the download of information, specifically the download of information of Solomon's Temple, Richard. How did that come to you, and what is that all about? Because it's something that, at least for me as a religious studies student, things like that. Solomon's Temple takes on a lot of different characteristics, everything from a physical building to sacred geometry to literal connection with the divine. So let's get into the download of this a little bit.
It does get more into that connection with the divine, if you want to call it that. Around, and I write about this episode in the book, that there was a point in 2005, okay, where one of those mentors I was guided to was someone I had gotten to know since 1994, Peter Moon, who the author of the Montauk Project books and Transylvania or Romanian books, the Bacchegi Mountains and all that. I'm at a meeting over at his house one night, and he says, hold on. He says, I have something for you. Wait right here. So he goes running back into his personal library, comes back out with this rather large, thick, blazing yellow-covered book called The Biography of Noble Drew Ali, The Exhuming of a Nation. Hmm. And he hands it to me. Now, the book is at least $100, okay, straight out. And he says, this is for you. He says, I think in time you're going to realize it was always meant for you. He says, take it. I said, you don't want any money for this? He goes, no. He says, that's not what this is about. He says, this is for you. Well, turns out I found out later on, the crone was watching that play out and waiting for that to happen. Because then, as I started reading into that book, I got to a certain point where all of a sudden a lot of pieces clicked together on what's been happening on this planet for quite a long time, which ties into the title of the trilogy, The More, the Mason, and the Alien. Crone shows up. This is like in somewhere as October 2005. And she says to me at this point, she says, now do you understand? She says, are you ready to step into the line of fire? She says, once you cross this line, there's no going back. But she said to me, you'll find out who your true friends are, and you'll suddenly find people coming out of the woodwork who will support you, while the people who you thought you could trust will vilify you.
Yeah.
So, you know, and knowing, you know, she had known my mother, my grandmother, you know, this goes back a few generations. It's no mystery to me that she knew the way my mom raised my brother and I. She knew which way I was going to go with that, but she was still giving me the choice. And I said, yeah, let's do it. And I think it was that same year, I just, out of the blue, I don't know how they found me, but someone calls up on the phone and has a UFO and Bigfoot conference going on and said, hey, we found out about you and we'd like you to come and speak. And I was like, okay, how did you find me? He says, well, I don't know. Somehow we found you on the internet. And I said, well, was it my website? Because I had UFO teacher going all the way back then too.
Sure. Okay.
I could never get a straight answer out of them. It was a bit of a mystery.
Interesting.
How they actually found me and how they got on the phone with me, but I wasn't going to say no. I said, sure. I would love to come and speak. And at that point, right up to the point where I'm being introduced to speak, all of a sudden it clicked. The More, the Mason, and the Alien, history, health, and wealth, and the three pillars that everything comes down to on this planet, historically and in modern times, because the two are one and the same. And right off the cuff, I wasn't even following a script. I did the whole entire lecture just on that instant of inspiration, which I know came from the Chrome, but it gave me a push forward. And that is where it went from 2005 on. Now, there was a bigger picture to talk about. It wasn't just me talking about my experiences with extraterrestrials. Now it was a case of getting into what's been going on with all of us on this planet. And that's what took it to a whole new level. Whereas prior to that, in the 90s and early 2000s, it was a different kind of a dialogue I was having. And then 2005 on, everything changed. I was still true to myself, but now the message grew into something much bigger.
All right.
So, but that tends to be what, you know, leads to people asking, well, how did you come up with the title of the book? Because most people, they'll latch on to the term Mason, they'll latch on to the term alien, but it's that first word more that kind of sends them off the rails.
Yeah.
And they've never seen, and I said, well, that's why I put it first. It was the best way to name it, the more, the Mason and the alien. The power of suggestion is a funny thing too. I had someone actually walk up to me at a conference and looked at my books. He says, oh, and this was straight out of his mouth, the moon, the Mason and the alien. Interesting. I'll have to read that. And I looked at him.
The moon.
I was laughing on the inside. I was like, okay, you run with that. When you figure out it says more, come back to me. Okay. That's, I called it that because the more represents the Moorish legacy, that spiritual insurrection that gave us a leg up to fight back against what I describe in the book as the corporate titans of Orion. Mm. The Mason represents that Masonic agenda, in contrast to that, that's invested with the bad actors to keep things on the side of greed and profit and tradable commodities, and we're just the chattel living on the land.
Sure.
And then you have that third dubious entity, and I just left it generically open as the alien, but that basically splits into two areas. On one side, you have extraterrestrial intervention, which sides with the Moorish legacy, and that investment in flesh and bone. And then you, on the other side, you have the alien abduction phenomena, which is invested in the Masonic agenda, and that investment in wooden stone. So there's those two esoteric concepts, flesh and bone versus wooden stone. So that's where it then jumps into as to what's been going on with our human origins right up to the present and how we got to where we are today, as opposed to the general consensus that says, well, ancient history is way back there and has nothing to do with us today. To which I say, well, we're finding fossil records from cultures going back 100,000 years, 500,000 years. And if we are going through some type of a planetary reset every 10 to 20,000 years, then obviously there had been a number of other civilizations long before us. And who were they? Where did they go? What remnants of them are still with us today?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's been a lot of activity on this planet. Some of it, you can look at it as indigenous. Others would be extraterrestrial or interplanetary.
Yep.
Okay. The fact that what's allegedly referred to as one of our primate ancestors, the Lucy ape, the Lucy hominid, that infamous controversy that erupted back in the 90s, that totally blew all of anthropology and archaeology out of the water, turned it upside down, because that general consensus said, well, we're going to find an ape primate with a larger brain, larger skull, and then they'll be intelligent enough to walk upright. Well, the Lucy ape completely denounced that. She had a smaller brain cavity, smaller skull. She suddenly walks upright with a pelvis that seems to have virtually come out of nowhere on the evolutionary scale overnight. So that tells me something was sideloaded into our genetic code to mutate that pelvis to allow us to walk upright. Because with that is not just a pelvis, everything else from the waist down changes. The kneecap, the ankle, everything changes. So to allow that, so does your lower spine and your upper spine. So, you know, how does that generation suddenly come about? Well, it's not just that. You mentioned the hominid of North America, you know, Squatch. Other cultures call it the Yowie or the Yeti or the Orang-Hutan in Southeast Asia. These are all different tribes that went their own way. It's as if these experiments were done, they branched off, and the general idea was, okay, let them go. Let's see what happens with them, especially us that, you know, that we refer to as Homo sapien, which is not even a real term in the first place.
And most traditional cultures that have these stories of these creatures, they are not a creature. They are the first ones to many tribes, things that they were the ones that existed here before we came here. That's why these agreements are the way they are. And it's fascinating when you look at that.
Yeah. There is a good reason why these larger mysterious hominids tend to be referred to as the first ones. Mm. I get into that history in the book too. It ties in a lot with the anointed ones who were now no longer primate slaves.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to keep it short and sweet, there's a lot to it that I get into in the book to explain it out.
Yep.
Way that everybody can appreciate, but these anointed ones, they became known as the Iesu, which is a popular term throughout history you'll find circulating through the Middle East. All right. It's where names like Asa come from, or Isa. And that Iesu over time is also known as the Adam, or the Atom, as the Egyptians were called, which is basically Ad, clay, mud, Om frequency, the frequency that awakens the beast of the mud and earth. That's what Adam means, or Atom. And to this day, they still walk among us, but we don't call them Adam anymore, or Yesu, we call them Sasquatch.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, these teachings, these ideas, especially whenever you look at Solomon's Temple, stuff like that, you're basically looking at the blueprint right here of just about, not even just about, but of every Masonic temple. It's literally a part of their history that they say, like, it's even a part of their initiation ceremony, the story of the killing of the master Mason who built Solomon's Temple.
Now you get into that symbolism in the book initially too. So with everything I just said, we can now land it at the front doorstep of what you initially asked about the Temple of Solomon. And basically this is a spiritual identity that has resulted in a very harsh conflict on this planet between, once again, the good guys and the bad guys. Because the good guys, they know it's a spiritual identity with the word temple referring to the human body.
Yep.
The bad guys see it as a chunk of real estate to control, so they never could comprehend the spiritual side of it. And it relates to what was essentially given to us by a race of beings called the Ankhils, and that was the gene for passion. I think, therefore, I am, as Shakespeare would say. Okay, yep. We weren't walking around like mindless drones anymore. And with that self-awareness, symbolically, the gene for passion passed through the Temple of Solomon. And when it came out the other side, it was the passion of the Christ. And that's where that whole concept comes from. So the significance of that ties in with what you mentioned, the first African god king or godman, Hiram Abiff, comes and builds the fountain. Now, this is all symbolic. We're not talking about something physical or concrete when I say this metaphorically.
Yeah.
He comes and builds the foundation of the Temple of Solomon with his magical tools. Okay. And it mostly focuses on his magical mallet, but he had other tools as well. Once again, those tools could be seen as the frequency of the term itself, Solomon, Sol meaning light, Om frequency on spirit. Okay. It's all in the word itself. So there was a jealousy factor there from the other side that snuck up on him. These three assassins, Jubello, Jubella, and Jubellum, which were once again the Greys, and they demanded entry into the Temple of Solomon because they saw it as once again something that was that needed to be brought into their sphere of control so that nobody was awakened. Okay, nobody was liberated or emancipated. And Hiram Abiff turns around and says, you're not invited, and this is not what you think. Well, they didn't like that answer. They didn't believe him. So they took his magical mallet and clubbed him over the head and beat his head in. The symbolism in that is that they were breaking his crown chakra, okay, and killing him. They stole his magical tools. Well, those magical tools were the essence, you know, the foundation of the Temple of Solomon and the Moorish legacy.
Yep.
Well, here starts the idea of stealing history that doesn't belong to you and then making it look like it's yours.
Yeah.
So this is where the skewed narrative starts coming into in our history books. And at that point, they could never master the tools because they weren't meant for them. It wasn't a physical thing. And at that point, once they realized, okay, this is a metaphor for the human body, the gene for passion, we want that. We want to target it. And if we can't have it, then we're going to destroy it any way we can. To this day, they've never been able to do that, but they're doing their damnedest to do so by, let's say, well, how would you destroy the temple of your body? Well, you would poison it. Food, drugs, water, air, okay?
Yep.
Big pharma. It's no mystery that...
Low vibration.
Right. The high priesthood of the good old days is now referred to as the pharmaceutical multinational. It's still a high priesthood.
Yep.
You know, it's still the one dictating what we can eat, drink, and, you know, inject into our bodies. Just like back in the day with when the high priesthood was hijacked by the Greys, there was a time where it was a good thing and then it went downhill. But what happened with that as a rebellion against that oppression was the Temple of Solomon already started. You couldn't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Okay. That revolution there, that spiritual insurrection. So the symbolism of it is that every Christ figure that came along, whether it's Jesus or Muhammad or Noble Drew Ali or Mithra or Buddha, they were all building another wing onto the Temple of Solomon to build it up even stronger. And that's important, the whole concept of building another wing. That's a reference to an architect.
Yeah.
The major Christs are known as master architects for that reason. Once again, symbolic. But the skewed narrative, it went from architect to carpenter, and that was the wrong way to go. He wasn't a carpenter in reference to one of them, Jesus. He was a master architect, and his own father, Joseph, was a master of the craft. In other words, that's a reference to a master teacher who took his son in, taught him how to be that master architect, because both he and his wife knew this was the path he was going to follow. And that's a very similar issue with our story with all the other Christs that have come along as well. The first being Horus, the son of Isis and Osiris. Yeah. Osiris. He was that, you know, as the story goes, the first Immaculate Conception, which itself tends to be a cleverly a camouflage term for artificial insemination and that alien influence right there.
Sure.
Immaculate Conception, although I do think it's also in the same vein, a reference to more of a long-term thing like extraterrestrial intervention over the long run through family bloodlines, maybe not something just so immediate. Okay. Because there are bloodlines on this planet that represent the control group and others that represent the experimental group. And that goes back to our human origins since the beginning of time. But this is, so in retaliation against the gene for passion, the human spirit, the Temple of Solomon, what sprang up from that is the Grand Masonic Lodge. So now you have Temple of Solomon on one side, Grand Masonic Lodge or corporate conglomerate on the other. Okay. On one side, you have the gene for passion. On the other side, you have the iron hand of oppression. So, you know, there are these comparisons here.
Yeah.
And I don't do it like that to get the point across. It doesn't, you don't have to see it in that kind of black and white manner. Okay. But I only do that for the sake of giving people a foundation to go from. And then I tell them, look, you run with it any way you want. These are just the bullet points here to get a good grasp of it.
Yeah. 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 And especially whenever you look at things like we regularly talk about the Knights Templar here on the show, and their realm of technology for the time, especially stonemasonry wise, and even the fact of like we have only recently figured out how they made their red glass, and it was using copper nanoparticles. So like they were using nanoparticle technology back in the medieval times, things like that. So the idea that they may have recovered some amazing technology and craft skills and things like that from being on Temple Mount, you know, amongst the treasures that they may have found, things like that. The real treasure, much like on Oak Island, is really the knowledge that was gathered there amongst artifacts that was gathered.
It's funny you bring up Island because that's one of my wife's favorite shows.
Same here, and it competes with my show and destroys my live numbers, dude. That and Skinwalker Ranch, and like we literally watch them like the next morning. Me and my wife sit down and watch both of them. And it's like those shows have utterly destroyed my numbers over the years because we directly compete with their airtime. But it's something that I say all the time: is the treasure that's been found on that island is the changing of history.
Yes.
Like whether you find gold or not, treasure has been found. History of the local area, history of travelers to the area, things like it's totally reset a historical clock, you know? So
what's interesting too is that you mentioned copper with their red glass, Knights Templar, right? Okay. So I first heard this come up, I think, from Graham Hancock and others in that field where, and it really lets us know how well the ancient world was connected as opposed to the way we teach it in history books in a very fragmented manner. And the idea is, well, where do you think they were getting that copper from? They were coming over to the Americas and getting it here and then bringing it back over there.
That's
That completely changes the narrative altogether if they were doing that, you know.
Trading with the local Indian populations. Yeah. And once again, Solomon's mines. Not many people think like, oh, rich with gold and silver. Copper was the main thing that Solomon was rich in. And people paid him tonnage of copper per year in taxes, things like that. So, yeah, the idea that they learned these uses of copper, especially the hermetic uses of it. The uses for healing and things like that, the antibacterial use. One of the things we talk about regularly with Gretchen Cornwall is the verdigris, the green that comes off of copper can be used on fletching of arrows to keep to keep feather mites. So if you're trying to store arrows and things like that, like It's a perfectly natural compound that you can use to treat all of your arrows and keep an army armed.
Interesting.
Know, things like that. So fascinating little tidbits of technology attached with copper that they would have definitely learned at such a holy site.
Yes. And you mentioned Solomon being rich in copper. It brings something to mind. I'm always talking about that metaphoric symbolism, but if you look at the legend of how he physically built his temple, okay, that blueprint,
mm-hmm.
it coincides with the whole idea, whether it's all gold or copper or whatnot. The point is, it was a, I feel what's shown there, very similar to the pyramids, is that it was an electrical conduit for awakening, which is what the term Solomon means, you know. And and if you look at Adam, or even the term Amon, the high priesthood, it's just a truncated version of Sal-Oman, Amon, priesthood. So
yeah.
That all comes from that whole idea of giving the beast the self-awareness to awaken it from the mud into the light, okay, with the frequency to think and be self-aware. And even if you look at it from a physical perspective with the way the traditional blueprint is for the temple, it matches that.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And once again, even the idea of number one, the temple is part of prophecy in Israel. It is even now. I popped up the article about the guy who was asked to design the new temple. They have actively purchased the red heifers for the ceremony from Texas, oddly enough, from right here in Austin. Things for the building of the third temple are on track, Richard. And it's fascinating to see how this has literally come into modern history and modern society, and not just in the way of a physical building, but also in the spiritual way. And in the way that these things, and that's why in the promo literature that I wrote up, I put the fact of, is it just a physical building or a spiritual means by which to connect to the divine, or even to find the divine inside of us, you know, which is a lot of the Masonic teaching, a lot of the teaching that kind of got the Knights Templar in trouble, was the idea that, like, you don't need an intermediary to contact the divine. You are divine.
I probably would have been a Knights Templar if I lived back then.
Same. Yeah. Same.
Getting myself in trouble with the authorities.
I would have smoldered on a stick. I can just about guarantee you, man. They would have definitely pointed a finger at me and my technology and been like, "Witch, get him." No doubt about that. But the idea that this knowledge has been transmitted across time. This knowledge has been carried forth in esoteric teaching. It has been carried forth in story, song, all kinds of things. And even carried forth to you and your wife through experience and messages from the beyond, Richard. What messages has Crone given you for the future? What can we look toward, things like that? How does that spiritual path lead us to the future?
It's funny you should bring that up, because at the very end of the third book in the trilogy, I rounded up with a conversation between her and I at that point in 2024, when she says, "Okay, you've done enough here with the trilogy. Let's wrap it up. And we've got to move into the next phase now." That next phase that she was referring to is official first contact and getting humanity psychologically and emotionally ready for that, so it's not a shock that sends half the population into a coma.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how adept we are at seeing a spaceship, a UFO, an alien craft, on the big and small screens. Sure, we're familiar with that. But if you actually saw the real thing land in your backyard, you'd still pass out. You know, just the shock of it all, like, am I really seeing this? Your brain has to process that. This just came out of the movie screen and landed in my backyard. What is going on? You know?
Yeah.
It's easy to use the venue of science fiction to talk about things at a distance.
And you know, Richard, we talk about that regularly with the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance and literally why a lot of films are written the way that they are. And why consultants exist in the military and things like that. Why some things haven't even have to pass through information offices with the government whenever you talk about them in a movie or in a book. It's pretty fascinating the things that you have to be like, hey, just so you know, I'm going to bring this up. You got a problem?
I think that final epic scene in Close Encounters of the Third Kind was straight out of consultation. The fact that he had, he did a cameo with J. Allen Hynek at the end there too.
Yep.
Walking through that scene. Because that whole scene with a team of people going back with them, I mean, that's straight out of real stories that came about in the first place, which as a kid, I didn't know that. I was just fascinated by the movie because, you know, my mom raised me on all this stuff. But In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy and Star Wars and all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom would always get me thinking, well, what if it's not just science fiction? And then Close Encounters comes along. And then because of that movie, that was a watershed moment because then everybody came out of the woodwork calling in about their own experiences that movie set something off inside of them. And I think it's because of Close Encounters of the Third Kind that we're even having this conversation today.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because people ask all the time why these things aren't known on a greater scale, Richard. And it's one of those, much like the Brookings Institute said in their report in 1954, much like the Vatican scientists said whenever they were part of the NASA panel that happened to people like, why did they hire Vatican scientists, like priests to come be a part of this Vatican or part of this NASA panel about interterrestrial life or extraterrestrial life? It's like, because there will come a quandary, you know, while the individual may be ready, humanity and the example I give is feel free to watch a bird, then feel free to watch a flock of the same birds.
Yeah.
And when one gets up and flies and lands, the rest of them follow and they get up and they fly and land. They tend to panic right after the one panics. You know? So while an individual can handle it, the consciousness of a group of people and the shattering of belief will lead to all kinds of different things societally. You know,
the group mentality will always take over, unfortunately. And they've experimented with that. And even you see it, like people are sitting around having a picnic. Well, one person decides to start making a fool out of themselves by dancing around and acting like a clown. 10 minutes later, 10 other people are doing it with them, then 50, then 100.
Yeah.
And they're all doing the same thing. And it's like the individual would have been like, this is stupid.
It's how a protest turns into a riot, Richard.
Yeah.
You know, like literally this is how humanity it's how a celebration that your team won the Super Bowl turns into a riot, man.
Oh God.
You know, like just the mentality of your team won. Why are you burning your city down?
Exactly.
That's a prime example of like why I think most aliens are locking their door on the way past Earth, you know, like, oh, no, I heard about this neighborhood. Roll the windows up.
I had that question come up recently, too. And I was like, yeah, well, guess what would happen if they suddenly came down? You know, first of all, there's the emotional and psychological aspect. Yeah. So that's one half. Yeah. The other half would end up worshiping them and turning them into gods.
Yep.
Well, then you didn't learn anything from that, because now you're codependent on it, thinking they're going to solve all your problems, and that's not the point.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's kind of the same whenever Earl Grey, bless his soul, comes to mind regularly whenever I hear people talk about CE5 and the actual push forth to contact, you know, that concept of please, you know, contact me. Like his experience did not turn out well, you know, and I normally point to all the books over my shoulders from guests I've interviewed where it's like, you know, most of these stories, even though they end well and end with a point of understanding of experience, they start off like a Disney movie, which normally doesn't start off good for a character in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like there's normally a pretty bad trauma involved that leads to the rest of the movie. Yes. And that's how most of these experiencer books are. Like something traumatic happened in the beginning that they later came to understand. But that initial shock, that you know, shock to the system is different, and it affects everybody in a different way. Some people can accept it. Some people, it shatters their whole world and their family relationships, Richard. It's not everybody has a beautiful shared extraterrestrial experience with the person that they love like you do, you know?
Yes.
That's a pretty remarkable thing that you have to begin with. The fact that A, y'all have shared experience with the same beings, but B, that you both openly talk about it, period. You know, that's a pretty rare thing to begin with.
We both had moms that were open to it as well. So,
and you know, that we're soon going to be having, Dr. Megan Rose talking about the normalization of paranormal and how we need to drop the stigma of paranormal and paranormal experience so that we can open the conversation and pry the keyhole open, because it's one of those things like I jokingly, but in all reality, at the remote viewing conferences last year, one of the speakers asked why you like remote viewing. And I raised my hand and I was like, as a man in America, I get to write down my impressions and feelings on a piece of paper without judgment.
Yes.
Like, I get to write everything that I feel inside down on a piece of paper and nobody's going to judge me for it.
Right.
You know? So when you have, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was going to say, I think you brought up a good point about normalization. I think what has kicked that off ever since the military's Tic Tac videos came to light, and then forced hand of congressional disclosure with UAPs and having these whistleblowers come forward. It is now, there's a, you know, we all know it was coming, but it was still like, wow, they're actually doing this. And I had to chuckle inside about it, because it forced the news media to eat crow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now all of a sudden they couldn't laugh at it anymore on news broadcasts or in newspapers. Now they're like, wow, Congress says this is a real thing.
Yeah.
And why have you been lying to us all along? Why didn't you tell, you know, it led to a whole flurry of narrative, you know.
In the last many years, I've actually sponsored the MUFON conferences across the country. Okay. And the first one was in Denver when the topic was UFOs in the media. You know, how things are being treated. And the thing that I kept saying that whole year was the flip in language to UFO denier. The term UFO denier began being used by the media. And it's like, pay attention to, like, in a psyop kind of way, people, pay attention to that. Like, that should be a flare being shot in the air when the media is now using the term like, oh, so you deny this exists. It's like, you've been using it as your funny story on the way out to commercial at the end of news broadcast at 10 p.m. for decades, you know, but now suddenly it's something to be taken with full sincerity, because, and I agree that it is, you know, I'm one of those people that, I think the only way that we get to understand what the paranormal is to expand our realm of known quantitative, Richard. By expanding that, we narrow that 3 to 5% anomaly every single time, even by fractions. So if you, in this, like I literally just wrote the intro because it never really had an intro to my field observation log. And that's part of the thing that I talk about is the idea that just because somebody has explained what's in the red circle of your picture or of your video does not mean, it means that, A, you've still contributed to the scientific study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That does not subtract your experience. That does not subtract the moment that you took that picture and the way it made you feel and the way that it made you dig holes and look and examine and think and the way that it opened your mind to a different world. It removes none of that. You have contributed to the scientific field of study and expanded the world of known quantitative, which only narrows the unknown to actual cases of the unknown. And that's okay. You know, that's all right. So
yes,
for you as an experiencer, because we've got you for another couple minutes and we'll let you go. But before we let you go, Richard, what advice would you have to other people that have had these experiences that you and your wife have had, to people that may be getting channeled downloads in this kind of way and don't really know what to do about it?
Well, one of the most apparent ways is start writing it down in a notebook or a journal before you forget them. Especially the profound ones that stick with you. But if you're waking up and getting hit with something that didn't quite feel like a dream, write it down. If you're seeing something that is in broad daylight, write it down. If you're seeing something at night, you know, once you start writing these things down, then you look over a couple of months, you'll start seeing a narrative building up there that may directly relate to you, your family, or the community, or, you know, society at large there. But if you are just having the experience and you're just not doing anything about it because you don't know, then it's kind of hard to find that subtle message that's hiding beneath the surface. The only way you're going to know that is by writing it down, or painting about it, sculpture. You know, it doesn't have to just be writing.
Yeah.
Okay. You could do it, you funnel it into your artwork. That's where I started out.
Yep.
Okay. And there was a narrative that followed through from beginning to end on that, which then, you know, of course, launched into writing the first book that led to the series. So all of that is tied together in terms of expression. Mm. Okay. And you might think, well, I'm not good at that. Well, I'm not talking about being good at it. I'm just talking about take a pen, put it to the paper, yeah, start writing it. You know, as the old philosophy goes, write with your heart first and then go back and write with your brain. So, you know, if you want to clean it up, but just get it down no matter what. And over a period of time, you're going to see something quite amazing revealing itself to you.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, quite literally, that is part of the reason that I made the observation and encounter log
is right,
for people that are A, investigating out in the field and going to the same place, but also people who are experiencing the same thing night after night, you know, where you can cry because frequently you may not think about such things like what time was it? Things like that. But when you see it prompted in front of you, you can fill in the question. And it's one of those, the sooner you do that post experience, the better that data is going to be. You know, you haven't started processing your experience through past life experience yet, through filters of belief, things like that. So you're going to get a much more raw, unedited thing the faster you write that down.
Yes. And that's an important point. Because people might think, well, I have a photo of it, I have a video. Okay, what else do you remember from that? I don't remember. Well, that's the part you needed to write down, because that snapshot is just one perspective.
Yes. And
you being there, you know the other details that can't be conveyed in that photo or that video other than you writing it down in conjunction with that photo of it. What else was taking place?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and that's something that I go into in the intro is the idea of, as a photographer and videographer, it's always one of those like, well, sure, there's a photographer that took a still shot. I took 60 of those in 1 second. You know?
Yeah.
Mine are just all strung together. But
right.
But even a video of something without sound, without words, things like that, it affects the brain in a different way. You think about things in a different way. And if you have zero frame of reference, and that's the example I give, you show a four-year-old that's never been to a wedding a picture of a wedding, and you have some explaining to do.
Right.
They have no frame of it. They're going to give you a totally different story than a wedding, you know,
exactly.
Because they have zero frame of reference as to what a wedding is. So like science wants a picture isn't worth 1,000 words. They need 1,000 words. Science does. And even whenever you're looking at something like this thesis work that you did, if you've ever been a part of a thesis, folks, never did them, but I helped many friends. And even art exhibitions, there's like a paragraph thing that sits next to this work of art that explains what the artist is trying to convey with this work.
That's what I had to do.
Because you may get something totally different off this. You may get a totally different impression, which is what makes it art, is that conversation of, well, I get something different. You know, if it's not impacting you in that way and it isn't causing conversation, is it really art? You know, which in and of itself is an artful question. But
I had actually done that. I went when I was finishing up part three in the trilogy. I figured, well, I make a point of saying I'm focusing on film, but it's not just about film. I get into music in a certain part of it. And then at the end, towards the end, I also rounded out by going back to it. It just felt right to bring things full circle. I went back to that original art series and started writing down in detail exactly what each piece was about. So if people are looking at the artwork online, and there may be not that they have to, they can come to their own interpretation, but if they want a frame of reference, you can see the descriptions of all that artwork in book three of the trilogy, because I took the time to explain them all. I just, it had been so many years since revisiting that artwork that one of the things I realized and putting it into context over time, your understanding of things change as to why that started off, that all of a sudden I realized, wow, you know what? Even my understanding of what I was doing with the artwork has now evolved over the past 20, 30 years. So,
And that's honestly, like, as an artist, as a musician, as somebody who's written poetry, things like that. I had a buddy that used to write poems and literally throw them away. And I get that artistically, don't get me wrong, but it was one of those, like, every time he did it, a little part of my soul got torn off with it.
Yeah.
It was like, but I can see, like, can see us hanging out, having a beer in 20 years and you wanting to read that damn thing. Like, and it'll never be there again. But I get that, you know, like make a rice mandala and then destroy it. You know, the idea of making something beautiful for the sake of catharsis. And that's a beautiful thing as well. But the fact that you as an artist got to go back and this has not only informed your conscience as an artist and how you've grown, but also as an experiencer and how you processed those experiences that may have, been a catharsis for you to literally do the artwork for, to help you heal, to get that out, you know, and to be public with it in that kind of way. Cause that's a big, big step. So number one, thank you for sharing your art in that kind of way to begin with, as well as your story of transformation with it a second time. The fact that it got to transform you a second time is amazing, Richard. That's beautiful.
I was glad I included those pieces in the last book.
Absolutely.
I thought it was a good way to round it out. So,
well, Speaking of which, it is time for the shameless self-promotion. So let everybody know where they can go to get the More the Mason and the Alien Part 3, Rise of the Invisible College, where they can go to see the artwork, where they can go. You have a couple of events coming up in July and August. Let's hear about those as well. So tell us about all that, man. Where can they go to follow you, everything?
Oh, yeah, fine. Our official website is pretty simple to remember. It's ufoteacher.com. It's all one word, ufoteacher.com. You'll find everything about us there. Our books are there right on the main page, but they also have their own link at the top for their own section. You'll find all five books there, part one, part two, part three, plus the prelude and The Kings Are Coming. They're all lined up there. Easy. You can purchase them right off of there too. As far as the artwork, you'll see at the top, there's the gallery. The main page also has it at the bottom, but that takes you right there. And I break it down into the sections I did with ego, because you can go, hit the arrows to see each piece in each tutorial straight to the bottom, all the way through. And as far as events go, there's the events link at the top there. That will show you my upcoming events going on. Hey, look, guess who?
That's me. Previous realm. Talk about shameless self-promotion, Richard.
Yes. But I've got shows coming up Thursday this week, a couple of them. You'll see them listed on there. Yeah. And also a presentation in August with the Disclosure Network of New York. Linda is going to be on the Alien UFO podcast as well. That's coming up. And then in August, you'll see there's the Meta Center in Chicago. I'm actually going to be there myself.
Great.
Giving a presentation to that organization. So like the link says there, plan your visit, click on the Meta Center. If you want to see me there, I'll be there August 23rd on Saturday.
Awesome. Richard, thank you so much for the time tonight. I look forward to having you on again and again. I will be touch with links for the official episode, all that kind of good stuff, once it posts to the website tonight when the feed is over. But thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your honest sharing and candid sharing tonight of not only your experience, but your transformation and the process of download and connection that you have. That is a truly beautiful story. So thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Have a good night. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Wow. Amazing conversation, everybody. When we come back from this break, while you're online checking out everything, getting your tickets to the Meta Center to go see Richard speak, you can get all those at ufoteacher.com, everybody. That is Richard's website where you can find all of his work. That's where you can find all of his books, art, everything. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe. And of course, Curious Research. We have all kinds of new stuff over there. We have our knowledge vault, of course, all kinds of things full of declassified government materials, programs, things like that. Stop on by and check that out. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend, Nikki Folsom. She is a researcher into the people of the Fae and more. We will be talking about the people of the Fae. Are they good? Are they bad? Are they real? Are they just myth? We will be talking about that and so much more with Nikki Folsom right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that break. Thank you so much to guest Richard Smith and his incredible knowledge on Solomon's Temple. That was absolutely awesome, a great conversation. While you are online checking out all of his work, make sure to stop on by True Hymn Science. TrueHymnScience.com is the website of our sponsor. If you use CBD products like I do, stop on by, check them out, get what you can while you can if you live in the state of Texas, folks, because it may be rapidly going away here. True Hymn Science and Christopher Lynch create an amazing product using a spigyric process. They use every part of the plant, stems, seeds, leaves, buds, roots. Every part is used, reused, combusted and reused until nothing remains, providing an amazing full-spectrum product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHymnScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your cart of $50 or more. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Nikki Folsom. She is the author of the book, Conflicted Reality. She has been on segments of the show before live at conferences. She is here for her first full guest segment. Welcome back to the show, Nikki. How are you doing?
Yes, Chris, I'm great. I'm happy to be here. It's been a long time. We've been meaning to do this forever.
Yeah, I know. And I was very excited. Number one, I'm very excited to have you come speak at the upcoming Symposium of the Strange. That's going to be fantastic. That is coming up June 25th right there in San Antonio. Stop on by and check that out, folks. But in addition to that, the people of the Fae is something that I refer to on this show regularly regarding numerous aspects of the paranormal and various paranormal phenomenon. How did you first come to researching people of the Fae and those topics, Nikki?
That's an excellent question. I've always been fascinated by the Fae, but I don't think I ever started to put pieces together until, I don't even remember how, it's been years and years and years ago that I started looking into this. Because my very first, I had an experience when I was little, five, of with shadow people. But as I've started to research and dig into different things, I'm finding, oh my gosh, there might be more to this than more dots that need to be connected. And I'll tell you one thing that happened. So my daughter's 25, and when she was about two, we were at Lake Georgetown, right up north. And we were walking around, and this is whenever you had the digital cameras you carried with you. And she leaned down. We were right walking around the lake, and she leaned down and she was talking to something. So I took a picture of her really quickly. It's just a snapshot on the digital camera, and took it back home and was looking at it. And I hate to say this word because everybody laughs at me when I say it, but the reality is this is what it was. It was an orb, but it wasn't one of those. That's probably a piece of dust. This was an orb that was floating. It was orange with like parts of brown in it. It was beautiful. So I'm thinking back then, what if that's a fairy, right?
Sure.
Never know, because they're typically, they could be a be show themselves as a colorful orb. So that means that if she was two, that means that's 23 years ago that I decided that I can remember when I started digging into the Fae. 23 years ago.
Wow.
And I've still been pulling everything together for the book that I've been writing. And the hardest part is figuring out what to include because there's so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. Once you start digging into it, I mean, of course, most people, whenever you hear fairy, the initial thing that pops into your mind is, of course, Tinkerbell. We have this enchanted image from days of yore of Cottingley's fairies that was considered so real that even the great writer of Sherlock Holmes himself swore by that image and that series of images, that they were absolutely authentic, that they were not fake. These are absolutely the real thing. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle like went to his grave believing that. And it's interesting because these are the images that we have. These are the concepts that we have of fairy. But when you start getting into it and when you start breaking it down, there is a whole nother world that exists there that is literally abutting ours with rules of interaction and everything.
Absolutely. And for me, what's fascinating is, you know, you might think that this goes to Tinkerbell with Disney, or even if you think back to Shakespeare when he started to differentiate supernatural versus human with wings, even back then. But this goes beyond that. This goes way, way back across cultures, across lore. And I mean, even before there was a written record, These stories go. That's how stories were passed down. They were passed down orally. They didn't have any other way to share them.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating to me. And to look and say, and this is where I go into all the rabbit holes, Chris, but to look at it and say, okay, how does lore in Japan fit with lore in Scotland that fits with lore in North Carolina? Mm. And then you go into the digging, you fall directly into the black hole of, okay, when the continents were all connected, what was connected? So these entities, these beings, were they on the earth? What were they? So you can get lost in this in the best possible way. I think it's so interesting and so fascinating. And I don't tend to dismiss any lore initially just because you just never know. You just never know what could be real or not.
I normally don't tend to dismiss lore because much like anything, they're based off something. They're based off an event. They are based off of a religious belief. They're based off a superstition that was passed along throughout a culture, what have you. But those points of lore provide us with a very unique and polished window into the beliefs of a culture and into what even separates, because whenever you start looking, like a prime example is Sasquatch lore in Native American lore in the Pacific Northwest. It is seen that they are another culture that lived across the river. They aren't something separate. They are something other. You know, and there are numerous things that bring back to things like fairy legend and lore, where it's like, don't follow their voice into the woods. You know, don't accept food from them. Leave food for them, but don't accept food from them. Because if you do, you're probably not coming back from their world. They own you now.
That's exactly right. And if they give you something, don't thank them for it. There's a lot of rules with it, but I still find it fascinating. And I am a person that my view, my thought about this is completely. The first time we met, Chris, I'm trying to remember the conference.
It was the Monsters and Legends, the first original version of Texas Paracon.
Right. So we were there, and Brad and Barry had asked me to speak. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to go in and talk about the Fae. around all these guys that have been investigating cryptids for all these years too. And of course I come in with my what if scenario. So yeah. I was just waiting for them to throw something at me because I genuinely believe that what if this is all fae?
Yeah.
I mean, they are pranksters. That's what they do. So
yep.
what if we're all chasing the same type of creature, of entity? And I think that there's something to be said for different lore about the fae and the way they present themselves and the experiences that people have, because I can't tell you yeah. how many times I saw a ghost. I'm like, that's a fae.
Well, and you know, that there is something interesting there, because there, I have a rote phrasing that I use for Sasquatch whenever we talk about it on the show. I say the same thing about UFOs, UAPs, paranormal events. I believe that there is a large hominid creature roaming the woods of North America and beyond. However, I also believe that there is something else that is fully willing to use the trope of our minds as a point of consent mm-hmm. to manifest here, or to even manifest passing through here from point A to point B. What have you?
I agree. Because we have so many people looking.
Yes.
So many people looking. And I love the fact that we're identifying new primates. We're identifying new species. I love it. But I do think, like you said, there's something to be said about the fact that we're not finding it. Does that mean that we're not looking with the right tools? Is it look sure. mean we bucketed ourselves to think it's a certain thing when it could be something else? So it's just about opening the possibilities, because we were talking before the show. We are all learning together. Like,
yeah.
some people have been doing it longer, but that doesn't mean that a person that comes in with a fresh idea or
yeah.
a new experience doesn't have a better solution or a better potential solution, you know?
Well, and really the idea of science, especially the idea of research-driven science, community science in that kind of way, is that somebody posits something and everybody else is supposed to kind of red team, you know, and poke holes in that hypothesis to see if it sinks or floats, you know, and no issues, no personal issues if it sinks or floats or anything like that. That's just what we're supposed to do, to weigh things to see if they move down the evidentiary chain from a point of data to a hypothesis into a theory, into a working theory, into eventually evidence.
Absolutely.
You know?
And that's the only way we're going to grow is if yeah. we do have those kinds of conversations, because if we are able to poke holes, that gives us the opportunity to go look at another avenue we didn't think about before. Mm. Okay. So I actually embrace that type of stuff. I don't want to dismiss. Okay. I want to move forward. I want to see what else can we find out?
Yeah, precisely. And with that in mind, what similarities have you begun to find, especially culturally across the globe, with these stories and even with some of the, I guess, characterizations, the characters, you know, because, of course, whenever you're talking people of the fae, you're talking everything from fairies to brownies to elves to sylphs to, you know, mermaids to... It's a panoply. Dragon. It's a panoply of critters. Brownies.
Yes. Oh,
gnomes.
Look at this. I'll show you this. This is called another brownie book.
Oh, did you break bounties? Oh.
No, I found a book. This is a first edition book that I found in England.
Oh, cool.
From 1890. A brownie book. How cool
That's
is
awesome.
That?
That's awesome. That is yeah. that is great.
I'm a fool.
And is that basically like just a collection of brownie stories? Or
it is.
Nice.
That's nice. Exactly what it is. I'm always on the lookout at vintage bookstores, especially when I'm in the UK for something like that. But
yeah.
But like you said, there's every single thing that you look at and you say, oh, that is an Irish folklore, or that's Irish lore. Mm. Actually, that goes to Germany. That goes to a perfect example is mermaids. Mermaids are across all lore. Banshees yeah. are across all lore, but they may not look exactly the same, but it's the same type of entity.
And their function.
Absolutely. Absolutely. the Kushi, which is the fairy dogs, black, or they're hellhounds or black dogs. You can hear them called all different things. They're through all kinds of lore across all cultures. And that's what I find so fascinating is if we go away, we're going to go away. We'll all go away at some point. We go away. In 100 years, the same stories are going to come up. The same things are going to happen. These creatures are still going to appear.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, precisely. We tend to live in cycles. We do things in cycles. And these things spread as we spread. You know, the only difference is, and one of the things that we've talked about numerous times, especially with people like King Gerhard, Ryan Edwards, Jason McLean, folks like that, when it comes to cryptozoology, is it's very interesting when you look at the differences between some of these very similar accounts, and then start looking at the ethnic population and where they immigrated from. You know, and when you start looking at places that have, like, for instance, wolfman encounters, things like that, you tend to have very Germanic and French populations.
Yep.
You know,
sure
people
do.
People who, that was already in their history. That was already an accepted part of their lore. It moved over here with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm Cajun. We have the Rougerou. And yeah, like that came directly over from France with us all the way through Acadia, all the way down. So
I found it fascinating. You know, I can show you, where's my piece? I have it all over my desk, but I went back to, I'm at 10,000 BC. I went all the way back and it goes back. Easily, but I was starting to go back and starting to put pieces together of when the continents split apart to say, okay, Scottish lore says XYZ, but then the same things are appearing in Appalachia. Why? Mm. Well, those mountain chains used to be connected.
Yeah.
Before it broke apart. So those types of things, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is plausible. This is actually plausible. And it's almost like just a giant jigsaw puzzle of putting pieces together. And we're not going to know if we're right or wrong until we move to the other side.
Sure.
But it's fascinating to explore and think about. And I think things started to pop in my mind when I, you know, after I did some of my experiences, well, throughout my whole life having experiences, I started looking at, when I was looking at the Fae and I was looking at the way they present themselves. And like in Scottish lore, you have the Seelie and the Unseelie courts, where the sure. Seelies are the blessed ones. They're the bright ones, which the way they're described is like an angel. They're bright. They're good. I'm putting good in quotes. I'll come back to that. They're good. And then the Unseelie are the unblessed ones, and they're large, and they can appear as shadow figures with red eyes. I mean, sound familiar?
Interesting.
Right?
Interesting.
So, and when I say good ones, when it comes to the Seelies, that just means that they are more compassionate as they can be. Because the way I understand in various lore is the way that Fae present themselves are more, I would say more animal-like than human-like, because they don't have that type of empathy that we have. So we just have to be very, that's why we have to be very careful and cautious.
Now, explain that they don't have the kind of empathy that we have.
So, you know how, when we walk outside and let's just say we witness, a snake eating a cat or baby cat. We're like, oh my God. Oh my God. They're not going to think anything because that's nature.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Yeah.
And that's the best way I can describe it. They're not tied. I mean, they just, it's a very matter of fact. That's just what happened.
Okay.
So, yeah, they're not going to sit around and cry about it like I would for an hour. But that's why you gotta.
Yeah. Yeah. And that idea, especially the idea, because we just had, Vicky Joy Anderson on talking about shadow people. and shadow beings. We have Nathaniel Gillis on talking about basically Solemnic magic and the idea of these shadow beings, this race of beings that have been passing themselves off throughout humanity, using this kind of magic, almost djinn style.
Yes.
And it's fascinating that you bring up this idea of the large, dark, shadowy figure with red eyes. You know, when you hear especially about some Bigfoot encounters, it's the fact of the eyes are glowing from the inside, you know, and eye shine, it's called. In a red spectrum. Same thing with things like Mothman, stuff like that. So,
shadow people are the things that I've encountered most in my life.
Okay,
believe it. And here's what's crazy. So I remember having a conversation with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. I think it was at Michigan about shadow people, and she was like, "They're bad. They're bad. They're bad." And I was like, well, that's not really my experience. She's like, no. And I have so much respect for her. But what I can tell you is, even as a kid, I called it the bus station. Actually, I wrote about it in my book, but I called it the bus station because I grew up in Pennsylvania. And in my basement, I would sit as a kid, sit and turn out all the lights, and I would just watch the stairs, and I would watch the little room in my basement that was completely pitch dark. But shadow people are darker than dark. So when I would sit, I would watch them move by, and they were tall and short and thin and large. I mean, just all kinds of different shadows. And I never felt threatened. I just felt like, this is just a bus station. They're just passing through. And I was fascinated. I liked watching them. Until one day, because there's always that until one day that the whole environment, the whole atmosphere changed. And when you've investigated this stuff long enough, you know exactly what I'm talking about, how it gets the air thick. It's like everything comes out of the room. And I noticed an extremely larger than the others, shadow figure on the stairs. And the reason I saw it is because as you went up the stairs, there was a little sliver of light that you could see to go upstairs where the outside, there was a sliding glass door there. So you could see the light coming in, and I could see it, the shape of it as it was coming down the stairs because of that little sliver of light. And all I remember is closing my eyes, and I thought I was going to die. I thought I was done. I closed my eyes. And the next thing you know, my mom opened the door, flipped on the light, and told me it was ready for dinner. And that was my first moment of fear with shadows. And that moment on, I've been a little more cautious. And I was like, oh, you got to be careful. Protect yourself with this type of stuff. So, yeah, I've been seeing them my whole life. My daughter sees them. My husband reluctantly sees them. He didn't used to, but now he's...
I tell my story pretty regularly about having a shadow person grab me and climb up on me while I was in a moment of sleep paralysis. I was also in some very hard places in my life with addiction, things like that. So I have come, my understanding, as I said with Vicky Joy the other night, is that that was kind of the primordial me that I had created and manifested, that did these things and did all those out of character things to achieve those ends, that did not want me to leave and actively go make my life better. I was getting ready to move and all kinds of things. So it was kind of like my golem me holding on to me. And that's just my interpretation of it. I may be absolutely wrong, but that one occasion, I definitely don't think was a friendly one.
No.
It's never felt friendly to me, even upon recollection years later, things like that, you know.
But what if, all right. Like, what if we all, I mean, you could meet me on a day and call me, you know, thousand names, or you can meet me on another day. super nice. So what if we're all right about the shadows? What if sometimes they aren't bad? Sometimes they are okay.
Absolutely.
One of the things that was fascinating for me, I was Dave Schrader, I was talking to him about it. He wrote the foreword for Conflicted Reality. And one of my favorite theories that he has about shadow people is, what if we're haunting ourselves?
Yep.
What if future selves watching over us? I'm like, that's amazing.
Exactly. And I was just about to say, when I interviewed Michael P. Masters, who's an anthropologist, works, I want to say, at the University of Omaha, something like that. He's on all kinds of shows, has put out the hypothesis that that if you project out the evolution of mankind by about 10,000 years, our anatomy changes, same way it did for us to become what we are now. And he's like, you suddenly start becoming a lot more alien looking. The cranium gets bigger. The eyes get bigger. The jawline gets smaller. So what if it is actually us coming back from the future? It explains a lot of the warnings of take care of your planet.
It sure does.
It explains a lot of the curiosity of biology and things like that. But one of the things that he said during that interview has stuck with me, and I've very much adopted the concept. And it's that a two-dimensional object, or a three-dimensional object, casts a two-dimensional shadow. And a fourth-dimensional object casts a three-dimensional shadow.
Oh, that's good.
So when you start thinking about that in terms of paranormal, and the idea that these things are not different than, they are adjunct to our reality. Mm-hmm. And that, yes, it may take a point of consent for them to entrance and egress this reality, or to even pass through this reality to another dimension of vibration. Who knows?
I love it.
But it's a fascinating concept when you start exploring that idea married with the idea of consent. You know, because I guess that is, do the fairies operate sans consent, Nikki? I mean, of course they operate on a different set of rules. Same thing as shadow people. Same thing as angel or demon or anything like that. Like they operate on a set of rules that are totally unethical and not in line with what we would operate with or call fair in the world.
Right. Well, honestly, they have the ability to shapeshift, and but I believe that they're actually smarter than we are. So could they modify themselves in a way to make us more comfortable? Absolutely. To be able to recognize or be willing to see it, you know, willing to see what they're presenting themselves as. And it's also, I mean, there's lore that says that fairies will present themselves in the type of dress of the region that they're in. So, you know, you might be in the Highlands of Scotland and they're wearing tartan. So, you know, a tartan plaid, or you could be somewhere else and they're dressing just like the local people do. So, I think they do what they feel is right for who they're trying to appear to.
Okay. And that was one of the points that I was getting to, especially with the idea of consent once again, because when you consider, especially, and this is something that I know we've talked about whenever I've had you on previously, during on-site segments, things like that. But the idea of paranormal, the idea of going out looking for these things, you have an intent, you have set an intent forth. And I posit regularly the fact that you should have nothing more than like a map to your location and a rote checklist of like, do I have my beef jerky? Check. Do I have my field recorder? Check. Do I have my field observation and encounter log? Check. Things like that. Like, see, check. Like, but if you're going through and you're reading stories about the location, you're watching shows about the location, things like that, like, number one, you're really polishing the filter through which you're going to look at your data and your experience. Number two, you may be well charging that atmosphere or even providing your consent for something to piggyback that experience, which is why I'm like, hey, feel free to bring a medium to a paranormal investigation. But should you really turn it into a seance and start actively asking questions? Because when you start actively asking questions, now you've set up a point of intent and consent to answer. So anything can answer.
Yep. And it does.
Yeah.
And it will. Not all the time. It will. It will answer.
Yeah.
And not always in the ways you want it to.
Yeah.
My favorite way to investigate is just EVP. That's it. I just phone and record if that's all I have, because I use that because I'm a firm believer that anybody can do this. They just can. Yeah. Because all you need is your recorder and your intuition. Like, just follow what you're feeling. Yeah. You know, if you pay attention to your body, your senses will tell you if something's around, and it'll tell you if it's good or bad. You just have to pay attention.
well, and that's just it, you know, going through and inviting those things, especially if you're inexperienced, if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't have somebody on site who's able to help with such things. Once again, I think that there's a large difference between generalized investigation and the way a lot of people put forth an investigation, which I think invites for a lot of possible issues, you know, for information to get hijacked by something else, for some other intelligence to pick up on that and take the place of. Which is no less anomalous, don't get me wrong. But it's fascinating what we are capable of doing. Even the idea of CE5 contact, you know, it's one of those, there were reasons why you did. Was it encouraged to call upon fairies for favors or anything like that, Nikki?
No, you don't want to be in any type of a contract with them. You don't want
well,
any favors.
Let's visit that idea real quick, because, you know, there's the story of the helpful elves that came and helped the cobbler and all kinds of things, or the gnomes, I guess, they came and helped the cobbler, all kinds of things. But where do we start mixing this mythology with, like, the mythology that's real of, hey, be careful, this is dangerous, this is another side of the spiritual spectrum that may actively be out to get you, or even embody you, or mimic you and doppelgang you to achieve other things. When does that start becoming fairy tale as we know it, literally by the word?
I will, in my opinion, we're dealing with fae everywhere. That's what we're dealing with, because of the different ways they can present themselves. We have goblins in lore across the world that present themselves with gray skin, green or gray skin. Know anything else with green or gray skin that we talk about often?
Yeah.
So there's that. There's, like I said, the angels, the shadow people. We have vampires that are fairies. So I mean, I think it's a fine line to say you don't necessarily want to run out and ask things for help, because you just don't know what kind of help you're going to get. And I just think you have to be, well, and not only that, are you willing to open a can of worms that you don't know how to close? Like, what if you open a door and things rush in that you weren't expecting? And I'm not talking about like teenagers playing with the Ouija board and this. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you just don't know what you're opening it up to. So you've got to protect yourself. You've got to be careful. You've got to do it the right way.
What creates that bonded contract between a human and a person of the fae, Nikki?
That is an excellent question. And I wish I could answer that. I think there's all kinds of theories. If you say thank you, that's supposed to be a contract. As soon as you acknowledge. So the question is, my daughter actually asked me this. So if I receive a gift from the fae and I can't say thank you, what do I say? I was like, say anything but thank you.
Yeah. Good on you.
Yeah, good on you. And I appreciate this, but just don't say thank you. Simple as that. And yeah. And that's cool. I can do that. But then at the same time, I try to do my side of it, where I leave milk or cream with honey or cookies or little sweets or maybe some marbles or different things just as an offering to them. Now,
does that oblige them to you?
Possibly. Yes, but I'm trying to do it as a almost a
award.
Like, you stay in your space, I'll stay in my space, and we'll just coexist. Because even when you look back centuries, that's what happens. People give their offerings to the fae. Even in Irish lore, you'll see fairy trees where people have built around them, where they put little bows or little ribbons on them, honoring the fae. You don't want to dig up their stuff because it'll wreak havoc on your life. That's not just Irish lore. That's Filipino. That's Filipino lore. There's all kinds. Yeah. So and there's friends of mine used to live over there, and I think they were in Manila, and they had a local who assisted them at the house who. The lawn care folks came and they did something they weren't supposed to do in the yard, and their helper came in the house, or their assistant came in the house, freaking out that the trolls were going to come after them. And nothing ever happened, thank God. Nothing ever happened. But the belief is there, the lore is there, and it came from somewhere.
yeah, precisely. And that, once again, that idea of them being in the woods, being just adjunct to our society. Go ahead.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is sometimes when you go out and interact with them, you go in with one thinking one thing and your whole mind is blown. I mean, I have an example when I was in Scotland. How long? A month ago? I have an example of that when I went and did some investigation, which it ended up being really weird, but went and did some investigation and my whole mind was blown, Chris, because my friend MJ was with me and it was just her and I. And you heard me talk about Reverend Robert Kirk a thousand times. And we made our way to the fairy knoll, to the on Dunes Hill, where the tree is, that it said that he is right there, where it said he's entrapped in this pine tree on the top of the hill. And Chris, we had that tree to ourselves. I've been talking about going to Aberfoyle for,
wow,
I can't even tell you how many years. We had that tree to ourselves, that whole area to ourselves, for at least a half an hour. So I said to MJ, now, for years, Reverend Kirk, and this is when we first started talking, and I said, I want your thought on this. I've admired the man because of what he did, and going around and collecting people's stories and different interactions with the Fae and his own interactions with the Fae. So when we went to the tree, the story of Reverend Kirk is that he was captured by the Fae. And I talked about this before in one of the snippets, but he was captured by the Fae and he's held captive in that tree. So I said to MJ, let's do an EVP. Let's see, we're alone. Let's see what happens. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? Nothing, right? So we were standing in front of the tree and I mean, we were probably 3 feet apart because she was like right here, I was here. And I was asking questions. And I said, if you're here, what can I do to help release you? And a female voice that wasn't MJ or I, very loud between us, said, don't. And all of a sudden, the hair on the back of my neck stood up and all down my arms. And for some reason,
you think?
I had a whole different view. And I was like, oh, my God, MJ.
What am I doing?
What if he's the bad guy? I was like, all these years, bless his heart, I don't know, but what if all these years I've been looking at him as like the person that's this fabulous, amazing person's collecting all this stuff. What if he's not the good guy? What if he, the reason he's being held captive there is because he did something he should be held captive for?
Yeah.
So you'll love this. So my back, where the tree is, it's in the middle, obviously, of all these other trees. And MJ was right in front of me, and she looks behind me, and she went, turn around. And as I turned around, Chris, we both watched. I swear to you, I swear to you, and MJ can come on here and attest to it as well. We both watched the tree that was a little, probably 20, 25 feet away from us. We could see something translucent moving in the tree and moving the leaves. And I was like, oh my God. I mean, I started to tear up because it was wow. So mad, because it was almost like a reward for me finally hearing that there's a whole opposite story that no one's ever explored. And I was like, oh, so I'm definitely going to write about that.
Yeah.
About my experience with that, because quite honestly, that was, now I have to go back and do more investigations, but it was such an amazing experience. And the beauty of Aberfoyle, because it's so small and so quaint, and oh, it was just phenomenal. And there, we stayed at a bed and breakfast nearby. And as we were driving, we were in the car and we both were like, oh my God, is that a sword sticking out of the water? So there was a sword sticking in a rock coming out of the water. And immediately I'm thinking King Arthur, right?
Sure.
Well, there's actually a legend in Scotland about the lost soldier. And that in a lot of the locks, you'll find a sword sticking out of the rocks. So cool. But I wanted to make sure I told you that, because one of the things I was talking to MJ as we were coming back down the hill from there, it's like a 20-minute trek up. But I said, you know, one of the things that happened with the Fae and why a lot of people turned on the Fae was Christianity. Because they were demonized by Christianity. Please don't send me hate mail. I'm telling you.
This is just the history of what happened to the lore, folks, and why it went away.
Absolutely. So because Christianity introduced the fear associated with the Fae.
Yeah.
And Reverend Kirk was part of that. I'm like, okay, so what are the possibilities? That's why I was like, I've got to ask Chris, because I know he'll have an opinion on this, a thought on this. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say if anything, you know, the lore of him sticking around in the area, things like that, is a remnant of the fairy lore to begin with. And I think also probably allowed by the church, because it's a stark warning, you know, that especially the church at that time was still very, and it's somewhat getting back to that point today where, like, they have reopened the College of Exorcism in Rome, things like that. So there is very much a light and dark aspect coming back to the Catholic Church in that kind of way. And that's very much what it was at the time. You know, it was still the time of exorcisms. It was still, you know, those things were not far down the line. So the idea of... yes, associating everything in a stark black and white way. There was no longer, but the fairies can come and help, you know, as long as you don't disobey their rules and we live in association with them. It became verboten to live in association with them, period.
Right.
And that became a very great, I think, scarecrow warning story, so to speak.
Yeah.
Of, well, that is what can happen. Like it happened to a priest, you
right.
know? So be careful. If it can happen to a priest, it can happen to you.
It can happen to anybody, right? Yeah. I find it fascinating. And I'll mm-hmm. you know, it's walking in, I love doing research. You and I talked about this. I love it. I do it for myself. I'll do it for the rest of my life just because I find it fascinating. Yeah. But to be able to walk in the hills or to walk in those paths, like walking in Iceland or walking in Ireland or walking in Scotland, and being able to feel that magic, because you can almost feel it when it's around, and I don't even know how to describe it, but I've felt it in the Wicklow Mountains of Ireland. I found in Glendalough. I found it. I felt it in Aberfoyle. Strangely, I felt it more in Aberfoyle in Scotland than I did in the Isle of Skye. And the Isle of Skye had a lot of lore. Yeah. So, and obviously I didn't hit every single part of Scotland, but I hit a lot of it. And it was just really, really fascinating to me. The Iceland, I love the Huldufólk who are, we were talking about the good and the bad of the Fae. So some people build houses and little churches for the Huldufólk, while other ones, then they say they do it because they're afraid they're going to take their kids. So there's definitely the fear that is still there today on the Fae.
Well, and with that in mind, you know, what kind of story, are there still stories of interaction? Are there still stories of sightings, things like that?
Yes. Okay, so that is my favorite. So early 1900s in England, there was it's called the Fairy Investigation Society, and it was created for just that, to gather experiences, interactions, encounters with the Fae, all kinds. And when you go in and you look, there's a lot of interactions with like nature Fae, like the ones that look like the Fae flowers or the sylphs or things like that. But there's also others, and it's all over the world. All these things are reported all over the world. And what's fascinating about this, what's fascinating about the Fairy Investigation Society, a person that everyone knows used to be a member of that. It is Walt Disney.
Oh, wow.
Once a member.
Wow.
Yeah, the stories are fascinating. That's one of the things I wanted to do was collect. So the book I'm writing, The Dark Side of the Fae, I'm focusing more on some of the darker lore that's out there. There's lighter lore, but that just happens to be what I started to capture. And of course, gazillion types of things you could write about. But one of the things I wanted to do is gather a book together and talk about people's experiences with the Fae. Because what's interesting to me is everyone's experience is different. Even my experiences are different. So some might appear as like a colorful orb, while others might appear as shadows. So there's a whole rainbow of things that the Fae have appeared as. So there's a little spark. My favorite story about the Fae, this is funny, is a fire Fae. And he's called a spark Fae. So what his job is to keep the fire burning. So when sparks start when your fire starts to go out, he runs out and relights it.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite stories because he just sounds so cute.
That's a handy dude to keep around, and one that you kind of, I guess, lives among the embers of your fire. But it's funny that is the case, because, you know, there was even the goddess of the hearth in ancient Greece, things like that. And that's just it. These things, these Fae had very specific places in that kind of way, very specific jobs that they did. Things like that. They represented even different elements and elementals.
They sure did. Sure did. It's Paracelsus that in the 16th century that created the elements for the Fae.
Yeah.
And then W.B. Yeats is the one, I think it was early 18th century, that he is the one that created the solitary and trooping phase. So kind of separated who kind of was the hermits of the Fae, and who that like to have a group of people.
Well, and once again, that idea of contract, just to revisit that, you know, but it's one of those, once again, they are precocious beings. And a contract is something that they take very seriously, but is also very literal, in its meaning. And that even means in the request, you know, it's kind of the idea of with a genie, don't just wish for 1,000 pounds of gold. You may have 1,000 pounds of gold fall from a helicopter on your head while you're walking through town. You know, you got your 1,000 pounds of gold. hope you're happy. So yeah, it's one of those like, sure, you can enter into contract with them, but you would have to be very specific about those requests and what you wanted them to do and what that was in exchange for.
And what if Reverend Kirk actually was in a contract with them? And that's
exactly. Well, and that's just it. Is even for an exchange of information, to make a contract, to learn things, to stuff like that. So yeah, there is that idea, and it's interesting that that dawned on you as you began an EVP. That maybe I shouldn't try to contact this guy, because what if he's actively the problem?
That, and I don't know what came over. I think it was the don't. It was the urgency and the EVP that I was like, oh, and it did. I didn't hear it when we, obviously, when we were doing the session. It was afterwards that we played it back, and our eyes both got as big as saucers.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there, even the idea of it warning you against not doing what you're doing because you don't know what you're getting into.
Right.
That is a fascinating prospect in and of itself.
I did leave an offering on the tree because I wanted to make sure they knew I appreciated any interaction.
Yeah. We've got you for about another 10 minutes. In that time, let's get into interaction with the Fae and what you can do to do so safely. I can't imagine that it requires like scrying white pentacles on the ground or solemnic magic or anything like that. Who knows? It might actually, but.
Well, I think every avenue with interacting with them, always proceed with caution. Always, 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 but always proceed with kindness. Treat other beings, no matter what they are, as you would want to be treated. I mean, you know, you're not going to go in and yell at your mother. Come jump your face. Why would you do that in an EVP? Why would you do that with a fairy? Why would you do that with anyone? Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But what you could do is the first thing with the Fae is they communicate telepathically. So you typically won't hear them audibly. I mean, I know the EVP is there, but that I didn't hear that audibly. That was in the recording, but so the most important thing you can do is listen, and just not with your ears. I mean, listen with your body, listen with everything. Also pay attention. You've got to make yourself quiet. And so you can see things, watch for things like when you're looking at the trees, is there part of it that's moving differently? Is everything standing still except for this one blade of grass or this one blade of something that's moving? Pay attention to that. Is it moving in a weird way? Personally, I have a fairy garden. I go out and I tend to it. The deer love to knock it over, but I tend to the fairy garden. And part of me wonders if the deer are shape-shifting into fae or into fae shape-shifting into deer, kicking it over saying, yeah, I don't like that house. But
yeah,
like there's things like that. Like you can leave them. They love shiny things. They love music. They love sweets. So you can leave sweet cream and biscuits.
Okay.
Honey, they love honey.
Is there a preferred spot? Like in a glen near a crook in a river, or like what nature. Kind of locations would you be looking for to leave these offerings?
Well, anywhere in nature. I've left them everywhere. I've even left them in my house, which is probably a bad idea. But I still leave them just in case. It is said, folklore says that they like to present themselves at crossroads. So if you, and not, don't take that literally, because it could be a crossroad of a stream. It could be a crossroad of roads. It could be the crossroad of time, like dawn into dusk into dawn into dusk. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Even a crossroads in your life.
Absolutely. So that's the types of times when they tend to appear.
Interesting. And is there any function to the people of the Fae, people of the Fae spiritually?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in the fact of, are they are they like guardians of humans? Are they, you know, do they have any kind of higher function in that kind of way, supposedly spiritually, or are they just existing adjunct to us?
That's an excellent question. I mean, there's all kinds of lore. Some say that some say they're assigned to trees, animals, just like kind of we have guardian angels, but
sure.
There is lore that says that they are guardians. There's lore that says that they, like the brownie who clean your house, some clean the hearth, some take care of the livestock. So it depends on the lore and it depends on the fairy. Because there's a goblin and then there's a hobgoblin. So the brownies and the hobgoblins are our helpers, whereas the goblins are, they just like to wreak havoc. So, and there's all kinds of different things that could be goblins. And I mean, I know people that could be goblins. But they house, hearth, all kinds of things. All kinds of things.
Interesting. Now, in the last few minutes, what advice would you give to people as they investigate these things, as they move forward, as they, I guess, go to leave an offering? What advice would you give them as far as attempt at contact if they're going to do that, and what caveats would you give them?
First thing I would tell you is listen, but don't over listen. Just like with the paranormal, you know, so there's people that just want to see paranormal everywhere, and the reality is it's not always there when you go into investigation.
Yeah.
So just be realistic with yourself, but have an open mind. Listen. What else? I set it out and let it be. What I do with my offerings, I just sit it there and I leave it alone. You don't have to come check it every 5 minutes, and you don't even have to check it till the next morning or whenever you go out to clean it up to make sure that, you know, the neighborhood cat doesn't get into it. But don't just treat it as such. I'm leaving it out for you, and then I'm coming to take it away. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's totally fine. Just move on. Don't overthink.
Yeah. Any words of warning, anything like that? Any caveats for people?
If you feel uncomfortable, the Fae do not like iron, and it is the theory or the lore about the iron is, the Fae were chased underground by humans way centuries ago by the steel iron or the cold iron, which is weapons. So that's why they don't like, that's what's said, they don't like iron. So iron will, they don't like that. So they'll be detracted from you on that. You can also take rowan, like a rowan wood, make a cross, and then red yarn around it is considered protection from the Fae.
Okay.
So you could do that. But as you, what I will tell you, so when you're investigating, those are a couple of things, but I will tell you as you're researching, do not dismiss folklore. Folklore is so important, and it does get dismissed a lot. And the reality is it's just so important. That's the first thing we had.
It is a culture's unique observational window.
Absolutely.
And it should never be skipped over. It should never be. I think it should be taken into account before most actual accounts.
I agree.
Because it's made of years of accounts. It's made of years of, even if it's cultural warning as to something else. It's important to understand that. And once again, a very unique window into a culture and what they believe and why they believe it. So, thank you so much for your time tonight, for your candid interviews and opinions on such things, because it is one of those that, you know, I think these topics get very hyped in a lot of shows, and I am all about talking about them. But I think, like you were saying earlier, we need to have a studied point of view. We need to be able to step back. We need to be able to look at all things and take in all points of data whenever it comes to examining these things, because if you are getting an EVP in every single paranormal investigation, it ceases to be paranormal. And now it's just normal.
That's right.
So you kind of have to take that into consideration. It's kind of like, you know, when you've had 8 failed relationships in a row, like my joke all the time is the lead singer of the band Boston. You know, it's like, hey, man, you got a lot of songs named after girls. Maybe take a little time off. Work on yourself.
Right.
You know, because I don't know that it's Amanda's problem. Right. I don't know.
Well, and if you're going to go investigate things, don't run out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's the fact of you've got to be willing to put that out there when you go out on an investigation. You've got to be willing to look at things from a scientific point of view.
Absolutely. But at the same time, don't take yourself too seriously on an investigation. Because sometimes you get more evidence. Like if you and I were just sitting there having this conversation, the conversation we're having right now on EVPing, we may get evidence because they just want to be part of the conversation.
Exactly. Exactly. And you don't have to invite them to be a part of the conversation. You don't have to do anything like that to make that happen. And that's just it. The energy itself will attract that like energy and things will occur naturally. But once again, you know, it's kind of like there was a guy right down the road from you in San Antonio that, belongs to a couple of online groups that I belong to and regularly posted videos like 3-4 times a week from his backyard of these lights moving around in the sky. And it's like, you know, you're kind of directly in between a couple of airports there with the Air Force Base. And, you know, and if you're recording these like 3-4 nights a week, it has now ceased to be paranormal. It seems pretty scheduled. Like I'm surprised you're here posting and not selling tickets. If you know, it happens every Wednesday, you know? So it's one of those, we have to be willing to look at those patterns and pull those patterns out and say like, okay, if this is happening every single time, it may not be paranormal, and that's okay. It's still an experience, and it is still an experience that adds to your realm of experience when it comes to investigation.
Listen, part of research is ruling things out too.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it important.
Well, and that's just it. You know, it's one of the things that I talk about regularly whenever I speak at conferences is the acceptance of what's in the red circle. Just because somebody like myself with 30 years almost of experience behind a lens and editing things and doing photographic recovery and audio recovery and things like that, just because I can tell you what's in the red circle does not remove your experience the day that you took the picture. And it does not mean that you haven't contributed to the field. You have contributed to the realm of known quantitative, which when you expand the known quantitative only narrows the paranormal to a smaller spectrum of study. So like you have fully contributed to the scientific data set with your known quantitative.
And you know, you're absolutely right. And we all are guilty of looking
absolutely
at something. Oh God. I will tell you really quickly.
Please.
A friend of mine sent me a picture from his Ring camera. And he said, what the hell is this? Sorry. That's what he said.
Okay, that was exactly. Okay.
And I'm looking at this, Chris, and I'm like, oh my God, that looks like 3 kids. That looks like 3 transparent kids. What the heck is that? So I sent it to my friend MJ and I'm like, please tell me this isn't 3 kids that I need to go help get rid of. And she's like, Nikki, it's a fly. And I'm like, oh, it is a fly. It was just right on the Ring camera,
right there,
seeing all the goods. But so, yeah, it wasn't 3 ghosts of kids. It was definitely.
But that's just it. That's just it. And you know, that want of confirmation is fantastic. But when you marry that with cognitive dissonance and the inability to take in new data because of a belief set, it can lead to a stymie in research. It can lead to bad things when it comes to trying to move things forward in a research field or even cooperatively with research. So,
Integrity is all we have, right?
So absolutely.
We're going to be wrong sometimes.
Well, I am in love with your research and exactly what you're doing with the world of the Fae and this idea of the contract with people. I can't wait to see what you do with your new book, Nikki. Let everybody know before we let you go where they can go to keep up with you, where they can go to find new things, where they can go to find the events that you appear at, everything else.
You can go to conflictedreality.com. That's my website. Or I'm on all the social medias. So Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. I haven't posted much on TikTok. I love watching TikTok just when I need to
escape.
But yeah, Conflicted Reality, that's my husband and I. That's my Facebook.
Awesome.
Well, watch there. You'll hear me complain about things, but you'll also hear me talk about my events.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, as always. You're always welcome on the show. Whenever you have new things, don't hesitate to drop a line. I'm also looking forward to having you at the upcoming Symposium of the Strange, Wednesday, June 25th at 6 p.m., folks, in San Antonio. You can buy your tickets at symposiumofthestrange.com. Nikki, thank you so much for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. While you are online getting your tickets to the Symposium of the Strange at symposiumofthestrange.com, everybody, please do not forget to stop on by Curious Research. CuriousResearch.org is where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log if you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP field research. The Field Observation and Encounter Log is your pocket size log to put all of your data in the field as the experiences happen, as you are taking experiencer reports, things like that. Stop on by and check that out. Everything goes to support Curious Research. And of course, CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to find all of our episodes. That is where you can go to find all of our media, as well as our free Roku app, everybody. Thank you so much for your time, as always, folks. It's always great talking with you. It's always great to break these topics open and see where they lead us. It is your open hearts and your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.